This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by Sprout. Sprout is the first ever discount club for pregnancy and parenthood. Born out of the reality of just how expensive having a baby can be, Sprout is here to help you save at what we know to be a truly expensive time. Founded by Sophie, mum to two, Sophie found the adjustment to statutory maternity pay a challenge. And when reflecting on her time as a student, when she had lots of lovely discounts, she found it crazy that as a new parent, there wasn't anything out there for those with little ones. And so Sprout was born. Since launching in 2020, Sprout has now saved its members over £28,000 and now partners with over 90 brands, including Jojo Mum & Baby, My First Years, Mamma Mio Skincare, Natal Active, Bloom & Wild, Latched, Bugaboo and so many more to offer members repeat discounts to help them save. Whether you are pregnant, your partner is pregnant, you're adopting, have little Sprouts or older ones, membership is open to all parents and parents-to-be. Either join for a year or life, and you can now buy a membership for a friend to help them save too. A lifetime membership to Sprout comes with a free gift box. And as a listener of this podcast, by using the code BUNINTHEOVEN, you can save 50% on a lifetime membership and sign up today for only £10. Yes, that is access for life for only £10 by using the code BUNINTHEOVEN. To join the club, simply head to sproutperks.com, choose the lifetime membership and enter the code BUNINTHEOVEN, all lowercase and all one word, and you'll be given instant access to the discounts so you can start saving straight away. Man meets woman, man marries woman, man has sex with woman, woman gets pregnant. This is the story we so often hear about how children are made, but this is just not the reality for everyone. My name's Holly Grant. I'm the founder of The Bump Plan, and you're listening to Bun in the Oven, a podcast that explores the myriad of challenges and routes to becoming and being a parent. For the last 11 years, I've worked across the globe as a Pilates instructor and advanced pre- and postnatal fitness specialist. During that time, I've worked with thousands of people, have heard hundreds of stories about fertility, infertility, pregnancy, and parenthood, and have learned so much about the often rocky road to becoming a parent, which I find fascinating. Bun in the Oven will dive into the many different ways children are brought into this world and what parenting really involves. I hope you find this podcast a huge source of support and that it helps open all our minds. In this week's episode, we'll be talking about what it's like to experience pregnancy in a bigger body. My guests are fat positive fertility coach Nicola Salmon and founder of the non-profit website Big Birthers, Amber Marshall.
And I had never advocated for my body ever in my entire life. I didn't even know it was a possibility that I could say no or have a conversation about my birthing choices and putting my foot down and going, this is what I want and this is what I'm going to have. So that was such a huge eye-opener for me that I could actually have a conversation with my midwife and say, this is what's going to happen. This is what I want. And you absolutely cannot tell me that I can't have that.
Nicola Salmon, author of Fat and Fertile, helps fat folks navigate getting pregnant in a weight-obsessed world and advocates for change in how fat people are treated whilst accessing help with their fertility. Nicola uses her unique fat-positive framework to support people in finding their own version of health without diets, advocate for their bodies, relearn how to trust their body, and believe in their ability to get pregnant. Amber Marshall created Big Birthers to provide information and support for people experiencing pregnancy with a BMI over 30. Having had two healthy, unremarkable pregnancies and births with a BMI over 40, she's a firm believer that having a high BMI is not necessarily a barrier to a great pregnancy or a healthy one. In this episode, we'll be discussing the experiences of those in bigger bodies, from the start of trying for a baby, through their pregnancy and to their labour options and beyond. Amber and Nicola have spent years looking at the research and sharing their findings surrounding fertility and pregnancy for those with higher BMI, and this was a fascinating episode. I hope you enjoy what they have to say and can use what you learn to support others or yourself. Hi, everybody, and welcome to today's podcast. I'm here with Nicola and Amber, and this is a topic that I'm so excited to learn more about. And
as you might know, if you listen to some of the other podcasts, we always try and have someone who's experienced the topic and someone who's an expert. But today we're really lucky that we have two experts as well, as two people who have their own experiences. I thought that what would be really helpful is if we just started off with maybe one of you, maybe Amber, just discussing the words that we're going to be using today and the context of them, because I know sometimes some of these words might be a little bit jarring or may feel like they're offensive, because sometimes they are used to offend somebody.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, whenever I'm writing for the site now, I always try to vary my language I'm using. So I might use the word fat, I might use the word obesity. I will often use the word high BMI if I'm referring to a policy that refers to BMI. So it totally depends. But just, there's no one word. I get asked this all the time by midwives and things, saying, well, what word should I use? There is no one word that is perfect, that suits everybody, that everybody's happy with. Some people don't like the name of the site, Big Birthers, you know, because they find that offensive. So there's no one word that works for everybody. I mean, I personally, I'm happy to use the word fat about me, but I won't use it about somebody else. But I will talk about fat bodies, or I will talk about, you know, I use all sorts of terms. But there's no one word that's safe or, you know, universally acceptable.
Is there a word that we should use today?
Not really.
So there we go. And that also sums up sometimes the difficulty. And I think why also this is a topic that maybe isn't discussed enough, because people are so worried that they might say something wrong that they choose to say nothing. Or we have people who choose words based on the fact that they do want to cause hurt. So it's so interesting just hearing that from your point of view. So as we have two experts today, I think we should probably start with you, Nicola. So it'd be great to get an idea of kind of your background, fertility journey, and kind of why it's led you to what you now do for a job.
Yeah, so my kind of journey, as you were, started when I was 16, and I was told that I wouldn't be able to get pregnant. So I was diagnosed with a condition called polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS. So this is like 20 years ago now, and there wasn't the internet, there wasn't the resources we have available today. So I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anybody else who had it. And I just was told by my doctor that I would not be able to get pregnant. I wouldn't be able to have a family. And the only solution was weight loss. So that kind of not only started my like journey into how I was going to grow my family, but also really impacted my journey with my body. Like, I didn't trust my body. I thought it was broken. I thought I was unlovable. Like, it had so many kind of implications on how I related to my body and myself, and, you know, so many different things it impacted. But as it happened, we didn't have problems getting pregnant. I got pregnant super easily, even though I was classified as quote unquote overweight and had 100 plus day cycles and didn't know when I was ovulating. Like, we got pregnant really easily with both our children. And because of the anticipation that I was having that it was going to be hard, that really meant that I was so anxious throughout my pregnancy. I was so terrified that something was going to go wrong, because that's what we're told. That's what we are kind of led to believe that's going to happen to us when we're in bigger bodies. And actually, it was Amber's site, Big Birthers, that I found when I was about 38 or 39 weeks pregnant, trying to advocate for my own water birth and home birth. And I had never advocated for my body ever in my entire life. I didn't even know it was a possibility that I could say no or have a conversation about my birthing choices and putting my foot down and going, this is what I want and this is what I'm going to have. So that was such a huge eye-opener for me, that I could actually have a conversation with my midwife and say, this is what's going to happen. This is what I want. And you absolutely cannot tell me that I can't have that. And that was like, that was mind blowing. And that's really what led me kind of through the kind of twists and turns of my own kind of career. As I started as a fertility acupuncturist, trained as a coach, that began to kind of lead me into understanding that absolutely folks can make choices about their own body and absolutely do not have to kind of go into weight loss and dieting if they want to get pregnant. So my whole like work, career, life's passion now is to support people who want to get pregnant in bigger bodies, but they've been told that they have to lose weight, they've been told they have to diet, and that the research does absolutely not hold up with that. And I really, really want to advocate for folks to get access to the support that they need in order to get pregnant.
That's a really, really interesting insight. And 16 years old is such a young age and such an impressionable age to tell somebody something so black and white that you will not get pregnant unless you lose weight. I know that you said that that then led you to kind of not trust your body, but did you take that information and think, well, I must lose weight then? Or did it actually lead you to think, well, if I'm not going to get pregnant anyway, what's the point? What effect did that have on you?
That led to 10 plus years of disordered eating. It led to me going on more and more extreme diets in order to lose weight, which led to, as we know, like when you go on a weight loss plan, you initially lose the weight short term, but then it always comes back on, often plus more. So it really just started this cycle of yo-yo dieting and weight cycling, where my weight went up and went down. Until I reached a point where when my first son was about 6 months to 12 months old, I was like, no, I'm not passing on this relationship I have with my body to him. I do not want him to talk about food and to talk about his body in the same way that I do. So that's kind of when I quit dieting, as it were. But yeah, it was, you know, my teens and my 20s, times which are supposed to be, you know, full of joy and excitement and adventure. That was my whole thought process, was just consumed with, what should I be eating? What should I not be eating? What should I feel guilty about eating? You know, it was all consuming.
It's such a horrific place to be in. And I've heard it so many times. You know, I've worked with women in the fitness industry for 11 years. And I guess I always hear the kind of pointy end of the scale, but women who have done such sad things to their bodies in the pursuit of thinness. And there's quite a common theme in the medical industry, isn't there, of just simply saying to a patient, you just need to lose weight.
And it's absolutely. You go in for an ingrown toenail, you go in for whatever you go in for. And it's always like, well, if you lost a bit of weight, so yeah, you're used to it. It's kind of, it does. What Nicola just said really resonated with me too. I've always been overweight. My family's always been overweight. And I've watched my mother and grandmother's yo-yo diet constantly. You know, my mum just yesterday was telling me her latest eating plan that's going to solve it all. And it's just, yeah. So I after a period of kind of teens and 20s of doing exactly what Nicola was saying, which is kind of obsessing over it, there was a period where for weeks I ate nothing but boiled eggs. I mean, it was just crazy. Easy ideas, but of course those work, and you get that kind of reinforcement. Oh, you know, I've dropped this many dress sizes, brilliant. But of course, as Nicola said, it always comes back on again. And then, yeah, in my 20s, I think I got to the point where I was just like, actually, this isn't doing anything that helpful, and just kind of be comfortable in the skin you're in, kind of thing. Which is all very well and good until other people tell you you shouldn't be good and comfortable in the skin you're in, but there we go. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's kind of, there's a lot of medical reinforcement. Either same, I didn't have any problems getting pregnant either, but I was told I would.
That's so interesting. And yet there will be, you know, so many women who are considered a potentially ideal weight who might then struggle to get pregnant. So I guess what would be really helpful is to know, what is the evidence then around being overweight or being classed as obese or having a high BMI, however we want to call it, and fertility or infertility?
The trouble with having a high BMI and being in that fat category is that you are lumped together with everybody else who's in that high BMI and fat category. And different people are in that category for different reasons. And so it might be that certain conditions that people have that have also contributed to their weight gain or their, you know, their size also contribute to other factors about them. So, for example, there are things like PCOS, and you're likely to be larger if you have PCOS, and you are more likely to have a problem with getting pregnant. But that doesn't mean you will, as Nicola's proved. You know, it's just, you know, it's luck of the draw. And you could have none of those things and have trouble getting pregnant, as you said, Holly. So it's sort of, it's very, very tricky, because whenever the statistics are done, they're often done for the entire group of people with a BMI of this to this, and they don't take into account that actually some of those people have got high blood pressure, and some of those people have got, you know, diabetes, or some of those people have got, there's all these different other things going on. And it's very, very rare to see statistics that have been pulled apart and all those contributing factors have been taken into account. So it's really hard to know fully how much weight impacts fertility and whether it does at all.
That's so interesting, isn't it? It kind of skews the figures. They need to kind of do some research where we show, okay, so I want to see somebody who is considered overweight but has no other health conditions, and then someone who's considered an ideal, or, you know, whatever we call that, healthy, although you can't guarantee someone's healthy because they're slim, weight, who has no other disorders, and work out, is there a difference in fertility between the two? But is that has not been done, I'm presuming.
No.
Not as far as I'm aware.
No. And none of the research that they actually look at into fertility and BMI ever looks at weight stigma and yo-yo dieting. Like, we know that weight stigma impacts access, like how many people can access fertility care from their doctors, general tests and treatments. Often people are denied those basic health, you know, health tests that they need in order to be able to access medication and stuff to support their reproductive organs. Like, when you go and see a doctor, they'll just turn around and say, oh, well, you need to lose weight before I can help you anymore, which means that they then, you know, will delay going to see the doctor because they don't want to go through that stigmatizing kind of meeting again. So these things we know impact access to healthcare. It impacts risks associated with health because people are delaying being able to access tests and treatments that they need. I read one paper where they looked at fertility and BMI, and they did find a delay based on BMI, but it was 1 month. So folks with a higher weight BMI, it took them longer to get pregnant, but it was 1 month. It just made me laugh because I was like, okay, we can say these things, but actually when we put it into perspective, 1 month is nothing.
Not significant at all, is it?
No.
No, I haven't read that one. That's amazing. And also, I suppose the other thing that goes along with that is, like you say, people delay doing things. And we do know one thing that does impact your fertility is your age.
Of course.
So when I'm being told, like, oh, you know, you should lose weight if you want to get pregnant. Well, how old do you want me to be? 55? I mean, my life's experience has taught me that losing weight and successfully losing weight is not something I'm good at. So if you want me to wait until I'm a perfect weight, I'll never be a perfect weight to have a baby. And actually, there are so many things you have to consider in your life to be ready for that moment. I mean, are we ever really ready, to be fair? But to be ready, like, you've got to have the relationship in place or decide you're happy without one. You've got to kind of have, you know, you've got to kind of vaguely think that finances are secure and you're happy in your career and all these other things. You want so many things to slot into place before you decide it's the perfect time. If weight is just another one of those blocks that you've got to move into place, it's just putting such barriers up for people. And, you know, plenty of us on the group, you know, we've got a big Facebook group. Plenty of us can attest that actually there's no greater, you know, there's no really reason why your pregnancy won't run just as easily and as happily and as nicely as anybody else's. You know, there's marginally higher risks for quite a few things, but they are quite marginal, most of those increases in risk.
And manageable, right? Like, we have the medicine to support folks and manage these risks, right? It's not like it's a death sentence or it's going to cause any increased risks to these folks when they're well managed and well supported.
No, absolutely. It's really frustrating to me. I mean, my pregnancy journey, I got pregnant within 3 months. I was gobsmacked. I could have done with a bit longer to get used to the idea, to be honest. And so I got pregnant within 3 months. And then I went on this kind of pregnancy journey where I was treated like this ticking time bomb where something could go wrong at any moment. And nothing did. You know, all the urine tests came back fine, all the blood pressure came back fine, all the scans came back fine. But I was still kept being told I was high risk, I was high risk, I was high risk. And I got to the end of the pregnancy. And again, I thought, I really struggled to believe that I was going to carry a baby to term. I really did. The first baby, I really struggled to believe that that was going to happen. And then I thought I was going to have a terrible labor. I thought it was going to be awful. And again, that wasn't the case either. I swear I had the easiest labor of anybody I know. But, you know, this is how it goes. I suppose maybe it's to do with, like, expectations. I thought it was going to go really badly and it was great. So after all this, I was just a bit like, well, hang on a second. What's the truth of all this? I was absolutely certain I was going to get gestational diabetes because all the information I had was, oh, you know, you've got three times the risk of it. You know, you're quite high. You're high risk, high risk, high risk. I looked into it. Risk of gestational diabetes for my BMI, 9.5%.
So you've got more chance of not getting it, a lot more chance.
10 times more chance of not getting it. And yet I've heard of some women with a BMI over 40, like me, having to be sent back for another gestational diabetes test and another gestational diabetes test. 7 is the most I've heard, because they kept not believing. And these the glucose tolerance test they give you is not very pleasant either. You have to kind of refrain from any kind of eating for ages, and then you have to sit around for 2 hours after drinking a really horrible sugary drink. It's not a pleasant thing to do. But this one poor woman I know was sent back 7 times, which makes me wonder, if they didn't believe the first 6, why would the 7th suddenly, because it reinforced what they thought was going to happen, why would that suddenly be the result they trust? It's all very loaded and very weighted, for want of a better word, against us. It's really frustrating. So that's where the website came into being, because having done a whole load of research about this, I'm actually getting quite cross that, you know, a lot of things I've been informed about, I'd been informed in a way that implied so much more than it actually was. And so I was like, right, okay, there needs to be some information here that kind of levels the playing field a little bit. And there really should be a site. And I realized there wasn't a site and thought, well, actually, maybe I'm going to have to do that.
And that's the thing, we can have all this kind of anecdotal chit chat where, you know, Nicola, you're saying you got pregnant straight away. And then, you know, Amber, you're saying it took 3 months. And you, for me and my husband, it took nearly a year. And actually, I had a horrific labor, even though I did all the things that you're supposed to do. And we can kind of sit here and be like, oh, well, I wonder if that means this. But actually, once you've got the facts, you just cannot deny the facts. And I think that's it. And that's why a website like yours, Amber, is so important, because we don't want it to be that, oh, my mate had this and she was fine, or my mate had this and she got gestational diabetes. It needs to be, okay, so what are the actual facts? What are the risks of me developing gestational diabetes? And, you know, can I still have a water birth?
This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by The Bump Plan. Given the theme of this podcast, I imagine that some of you are currently pregnant or planning a family. So many women I know just aren't sure how to move their body safely during this changing time. Or they want to stay active but need someone to show them the way and hold their hand. That's where the Bump Plan comes in. The Bump Plan is a holistic prenatal fitness plan that allows you to work out with confidence at each trimester of your pregnancy. Founded by myself, Holly Grant, the Bump Plan has already helped over 10,000 pregnant women stay active safely and feel empowered throughout their pregnancies. Through its trimester-specific workouts, in which I'm always at the same stage of my pregnancy as you will be in yours, hypnobirthing subscription and extensive education hub, you'll feel supported and part of a welcome community. Let me help you move safely through your pregnancy, maintain your fitness and strength, and enter parenthood strong and prepared for all the demands it poses. As a listener of Bun in the Oven, I'm offering you £5 per month off the cost of your monthly subscription to the Bump Plan, simply by entering the code BUN at checkout. To get started today, simply head to pilatespt.co.uk/the-bump-plan and enter the code BUN at checkout. That's B-U-N in lowercase to get £5 off the monthly cost of the Bump Plan. Join our community today and stay strong throughout your pregnancy.
So is there, I know that you mentioned that lots of these health risks are marginal. Is there anything that we can't deny? Is it riskier from everything that you've read? Kind of, is it riskier to have a higher BMI, or is it very small?
Yeah, absolutely. It is definitely riskier. It's without a doubt riskier, but it's about how much. When that risk is 0.01% and it jumps to 0.02%, it's double the risk. Undoubtedly, it's double the risk, but it's still a really low risk. And it's about how that information is portrayed. So yes, no, you are, I can reel them off. You are at increased risk of high blood pressure, preeclampsia, postpartum hemorrhage, stillbirth, miscarriage. What have I left off, Nicola? Like practically anything.
Pretty much.
In fact, you're less likely to have an instrumental birth, but you're more likely to have a cesarean section.
Less likely to tear, aren't you?
You are less likely to tear. They never tell you that one.
That's a lovely one.
Yeah, they tell you all the things that are worse, but they never tell you the things that are better. You're less likely to want to instigate breastfeeding. You're less likely to succeed at breastfeeding. You're less, you know, there are so many statistics that show that we in bigger bodies are more likely to have problems. But as I've already said, it is very, very worthwhile looking at that data and trying to pull it apart and go, hang on a second, is this everybody with a high BMI, or is this people who have my exact circumstances with a high BMI? Because that's what I kept trying to pull apart when I was pregnant, especially with my second child. They would say, oh, you're more at risk of this. I'm like, hang on a second, this data didn't account for the fact that I don't have high blood pressure, I don't have this, I don't have that, I don't have the other. What is my risk? And it's very, very difficult to find that out. I mean, we've recently been, Nicola and I have recently been involved in some research, and we were very keen to get them to pull out that kind of data. And you know what? It was fascinating because we were right. It did show that particularly if you were having a second baby, your chances of having that second baby, if you've already had one and it was a vaginal birth with no issues, your chances were like 90 something percent, weren't they, of doing it again? It was huge. So actually, rather than BMI being a really strong predictor of what's likely to happen in labor, it turned out that what had already happened previously was a really good indicator of what had happened in labor, and the BMI wasn't quite so there. So it was interesting. And they also pulled apart different kind of different categories of kind of difficulty you might have, different kind of complications you might have. And yeah, it did show in quite a lot of categories that it did make a difference if you pulled out that data and looked at people in different groups.
I think it often comes back to something that people really struggle to get their head around. And it's essentially weight stigma, is that you can have somebody who has a high BMI who is healthy, and then you can have somebody who has a low BMI or what's considered a regular BMI who is very unhealthy. And weight is not an absolute determinator of how healthy you are. And do you guys kind of feel that you don't get that same level of understanding or support from the medical industry?
Absolutely. I mean, when we're looking at risk, stuff like risk, which is really important to look at, because there is, you should not, you know, be able to consent to something like getting pregnant until you know what the risks are. And it's really important that you can consent to those. But we're never looking at, you know, there are no like biological mechanisms that people have identified that say, because you have fat cells around your middle, therefore that means that this is going to happen, which then causes that risk. We just know that there's a correlation between BMI and these risks happening. We're not actually exploring like how fat people are experiencing pregnancy, the stress and the pressure that they're put under to maintain a particular weight or not put too much weight on, or, you know, all these microaggressions that they face, like having 7 glucose tolerance tests, or being, you know, being physically hurt by your scanner when you're having your scans at the clinic. You know, I've had so many people say that they've been, you know, physically hurt because they've pushed so hard because they're not trained properly in how to scan fat bodies, you know, and the way that they're commented on and the way that they're talked to. Like, these things have a real implication on people's stress levels, and that impacts health. You know, health is so much bigger than just what we eat and how we move, right? So it's really, really important that we look at bigger pictures around this and really look at what is going on for fat folks, the environment they're in, the way they are treated by the medical system, and how that impacts the health of their pregnancy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the classic case is you go into a room and they start like, I mean, one of the ones I had, when you're bigger, you get these manual handling risk assessments because you're deemed to be a risk to the people who are caring for you, which I can understand. Fair enough. You don't want them doing the backs in. But you just saw me walk through the door and sit down. You don't need to ask that question. It's offensive to kind of, yeah, to just kind of ask something like that when you've literally just seen me do it. But then, you know, these kind of questions continue, and people sort of, sometimes you'll have somebody who'll say to you, oh, right, now you need to cut out the junk food. You didn't ask me if I eat junk food. how can I cut out something that I'm not eating? You haven't checked. You need to get more exercise. When I was told that, I was already doing like 3 or 4 sessions of aqua aerobics a week. Like, that's probably okay.
Yeah, and well, obviously my background is prenatal fitness and fitness in general. And so, you know, one thing I know is that for lots and lots of women, exercise is a huge part of their kind of mental health care, as well as their physical health care. What we hear for a lot of women who come to us and say, you know, I've been told I've got a high BMI and that I'm considered high risk. And so am I safe to exercise? And one of the problems is that if you are considered high risk, or as soon as you're put into that bracket, not only are you nervous and you're told that you're fragile, and like you said, Amber, you know, you're treated like you're a ticking time bomb. Well, that's not going to make you want to do exercise because you're worried you might harm yourself or your baby. Or as soon as you're considered high risk, a lot of health professionals will not be allowed to teach you exercise. And it is considered sometimes as a contraindication. And so it's so ironic that when you're trying for a baby, they're saying to you, try and lose weight. As Nicola has said, lots of women will then try things that are not particularly healthy to then lose weight. And then also on top of that, try for a baby. And then when you are considered high risk, you're less likely to feel safe exercising or be allowed to exercise at a time where they are then also putting pressure on you to manage your weight. And it just feels like the way that we talk to pregnant women, we shouldn't be teaching them or talking to them in a way that makes them feel scared and fragile. And for you guys, just because you happen to be in a bigger body, taking aside what your health is like, you might be super, super healthy, you might not be, you're all treated under this umbrella term. And then that just means that you're less likely to want to move and be active during your pregnancy, which to me is just such a shame.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of irony in treatment when you're pregnant and you're big. I mean, you know, you're told all along that it'll help your labour if you're active, but lie on that bed so we can strap you to this monitor because we want to check the baby's okay. We know that water's really, really good at kind of facilitating kind of calm and lowering your blood pressure. And women with high BMIs are more likely to have high blood pressure, but no, you can't get in a pool. So it's just, there's an awful lot of these kind of just complete oxymorons of like you should do this but you can't because you're bigger, but you benefit from it more because you're bigger, because you're more at risk of it because you're bigger. Or are you more at risk of it? Who knows? It does feel like a complete maze at times. And picking up on something Nicola said earlier as well, yes, I mean, I said yes, there is a risk of being higher risk being higher if you're bigger, but as Nicola said, actually that's not proven as a causal link. That's it's a correlation at best. That's all we've got. So, you know, it's very much, and also I suppose there's so much loading with it as well. There's so much like, well, it's your fault. You did this to yourself. You know, you've come in here with a broken leg. Oh, poor you. That's a bad thing. You come in here with a fat body. And how have you let yourself get here? Kind of thing. There's such a lot of judgment that comes with it. Not from all the healthcare professionals. I had some great healthcare professionals. In fact, I made sure I ditched my GP's midwife to go to a different midwife at the Sure Start Centre when I was pregnant with my second. And she was great. But yeah, finding the right professional sometimes is the key, because you've got to have those people who've got your back and who can deal with you sensibly and not turn this all into like a pile on of guilt and judgment.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And so Amber, you mentioned that because of the way you were talked to and treated and told that you're high risk, you kind of didn't necessarily trust that you would end up with a baby at the end of this. Nicola, how was pregnancy for you? Did you find that messaging then made your pregnancy scary or less enjoyable than you thought it would be?
Oh, absolutely. Like Amber said, every single thing I thought that could go wrong, I thought was going to go wrong. I thought I had an ectopic pregnancy. I thought I was going to have a pregnancy loss. I thought I was going, you know, every single appointment, I thought, this is where the shoe's going to drop, right? This is where it's all going to go wrong and it's, you know, going to go badly, but nothing happened. And that's not to say that, you know, people where it does go wrong, that it's their fault, because it's absolutely not. Like, we know folks of all bodies have complications during pregnancy, and it is absolutely nothing to do with what they've done or the size of their body or anything. It's just that these things happen. And that is why we are so lucky to have the NHS and an incredible healthcare system for the most part, because when something does go wrong, we have that support there to be able to support us through that. But when it comes with that side of shame and judgment and, like Amber said, responsibility and the kind of the blame game where they say that, you know, it's your fault, which happens a lot for fat people. You know, I've had people tell me that when they've been actively in a miscarriage, that they've been told by their doctor, well, if you'd have lost weight before you've got pregnant, this wouldn't be happening. Like, that is just traumatic for so many folks, and it should not be happening. And this is the kind of thing that really drives me to do the work that I do, because people should not be treated in that way. It's just unethical and completely immoral.
No, I mean, I had a message from somebody who was desperately wanting a baby, had got pregnant, had gone to, I think she was in America, to be fair, but she'd gone to her obstetrician to talk about it, and he'd made her feel so terrible that she came back from that thing going, do you know what, maybe I should have a termination, try and lose some weight, and then I'll be in a better place to have a baby. And it's just, if this is the message people are getting about how terrible their bodies are, and that's not my experience, and that's not borne out by the statistics, and that's, you know, that, but that is the impression you're given, that is the kind of message we get from some professionals, and it's just so ridiculously unfair and unwanted. And just, and like you said, with the kind of the mental health aspect, we did some research a while back about women's experiences. In fact, that's what a lot of these quotes are up here. This was the good stuff, this was what they wanted. I've got another banner that shows like what they got that wasn't what they wanted, but anyway, but yeah, we did some research into this. And yeah, so many of them said that everything was about BMI, 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 but nothing looked at their mental health, how they were coping, and how the treatment they received impacted on their mental health and how they were coping. And like, we know cortisol's not good for us, and you know cortisol's a stress hormone, so why is kind of promoting cortisol to fat women when they're pregnant, you know, why is that a good thing? So it becomes so frustrating.
Yeah, we're sort of, you like, we're putting weight on a pedestal and forgetting that there are so many other health aspects that affect your pregnancy. Like you've mentioned, stress, you know, and inactivity and all these sorts of things. And actually, yeah, we kind of don't need to be pushing weight so high up. You know, there are so many different reasons why, or so many other things people need to be doing. So I know that when you are considered high risk, that also changes your birth options as well. So what happens then? Because I mean, I was low risk, and then I had obstetric cholestasis, and then I went to high risk. And so I just remember feeling like, oh, I can't have a midwife led, you know, I can't have a birth pool. Is that kind of just a given for you guys from day one?
We're fighting it.
Yeah, I mean, for me it was like, absolutely, as soon as I was measured and weighed, that was it, like stamped high risk and off you go, consultant led care. But yeah, it was, I mean, like they, like I said before, like they can't tell you what you can and cannot do with your birth choices. Like they legally cannot tell you that you can and cannot have these choices, and they can choose to support you sometimes or not, but they cannot legally deny you what you want to do, which is why I ended up advocating for a home birth. It didn't happen in the end due to circumstances with my birth. I got meconium in my waters when my waters broke, but I was there, I was ready to have my home birth, which was like, I felt like Superwoman. It was like the most cool thing I'd ever done with my life at that point, was just like advocating for myself and getting what I wanted, even in the face of adversity.
Yeah, absolutely. Same here. So it's getting better. It is getting better. So yeah, my youngest is 9. And at that point, it was still a blanket. BMI over 35, I think, was in my area. And my BMI was 44. I'm not even close. So yeah, it was a blanket BMI on midwife led unit. Not a hope. In some areas, there's been success with people going, I'm having a home birth. If you don't let me in the midwife led unit, I'm definitely having a home birth. I'm having a home birth. And funnily enough, those doors open. Sometimes, not always, sometimes. So that's one option. The other thing that people can do is they can insist on having an appointment with the head of midwifery or the supervisors of midwives or the consultant midwife. They've got different terms in different trusts, but insist on basically speaking to the top midwife, because that person, he or she, will have the ability probably to sign your birth plan off, and they can do things that are a bit, they can look at you and kind of talk to you about your choices and your, you know, what's happened so far in your pregnancy, and they can often go, actually, I'm fine with you having a midwife-led unit birth, and sign you off. So that can help, but get it in writing. So my personal story was, so my first was planned to be a hospital birth, because like I said, I thought it was all going to go wrong, so why wouldn't I? Planned to have a hospital birth. I planned to use the pool. I was very, very keen on using the pool. I'm a huge, you know, water person. I love swimming, I love baths, you know, everything. Water's good for me. I had a feeling that water was going to be something I needed. And so I had 3 baths in labour. But despite having said in every obstetric appointment, every midwifery appointment at the hospital, having had the tour and been shown the room where I would be able to go, on the day I was refused access, on the day I was told it's being fixed, there's somebody in it. No, there can't be somebody in it. It was being fixed 7 hours ago, and you know I'm waiting for it. There's no way there's somebody in it now. We haven't got enough trained staff on today. It needs to be cleaned. As soon as you get multiple excuses for something, you know it's lies, or at least some of them are. So it got to me basically getting to the point of like I was like 10 centimeters dilated, and I was furious that this wasn't happening. And so yes, my stats all went completely haywire, and they were like, you need to push this baby out now, or we're going to take you to we're going to kind of cut you open, because yeah, we're concerned because her stats have gone haywire. Now in hindsight, I think, well yeah, no wonder her stats went haywire, my adrenaline went through the roof. I was furious. So second time round, still no option of a midwife-led unit. But at this point, I was like, I'm not sure I trust them. Even if they said I could use a midwife-led unit, they said I could use the pool, and I didn't. So this time, home birth or nothing. I'm having no truck with anybody telling me anything else. I'm having a home birth, and it is happening. And so, yeah, I swapped hospitals. I changed midwife teams. I did basically everything that was required until I got my home birth, and it was fabulous.
I think it's amazing that as well that you felt so strongly and you felt confident and you were able to advocate for yourself. I think sometimes the danger is that if they keep saying to you like, well, as long as you know the risks and as long as you sign this and sign your life away.
Yeah. Oh, I had to sign my life away. I had to sign something to say that I understood it was against medical advice, and if anything went wrong, it was all on my head. Oh yeah, I had to sign that.
And spelling that out to somebody makes it a very difficult decision then, because there's always going to be that element in the back of your mind. But if something goes wrong, will I forgive myself?
Absolutely.
And if you're constantly met with people saying, are you sure this is the right thing? You know, we don't think that. It's very difficult to advocate for yourself when people are telling you constantly that you're doing the right thing.
It is. It really helps if you've got. So I did have my community midwife who was very much like, I can see no problem with this. And I had the head of midwifery, although she was the person who had to get me to sign the piece of paper, she was very clear that, like, I can't see that there's going to be a problem here. There's, you know, your first labour went fine. There's no reason to believe it won't. I lived 10 minutes walk from the hospital. So, you know, there are multiple things in my favour. But yes, you do need that supportive voice. My partner was very supportive. So it did all... You do need some backup. You can't do this on your own if you're going to kind of push the boundaries and kind of say, no, actually, this is important to me. And yes, my risk is marginally higher. But actually, the trouble is, I believe that the way sometimes we're treated in hospital makes those incidences. And I'm not alone in thinking this. This isn't just off the top of my head. There's some statistics. There's some research that Canada they've done to show that actually, if you don't treat people differently in labor, because the trouble is they go, well, you're bigger, we might have trouble putting an epidural in, should we put one in now to just save time later, kind of thing. And that's already changed the course of your labor. You've already interfered a little bit. You know, when they say kind of, oh, you know, it's really good to have an active labor, but actually, could you just stay on the couch a little bit longer, because I just like a little bit longer of a trace. All of these little interferences can add up and become what's known as a spiral of interventions, where you just end up with kind of, you know, basically eventually, unfortunately, quite often an emergency cesarean section. And then the trouble is, you then look at the data and go, well, she was fat, of course she ended up with a cesarean section, she was statistically more likely. So this is what this Canadian study did. They tried to pull this apart and go, if you don't do that, does it make a difference? And they found that yeah, it really does, actually. So was I actually safer in my own home?
You know, and it's the chicken or the egg, isn't it? Like, are the interventions causing the increased cesareans, or is it the, you know, other way around, if they're just happening to be the increased cesareans? And that's
Course, if anything had gone wrong at my home birth, absolutely, you know, a catastrophic event would have been, you know, absolute proof that, you know, I'd been ridiculously reckless. But of course, the thing is that home births so very, very rarely go badly wrong, because you have trained people there who know what to look for. And rather than, you know, when I was in hospital, I saw my midwife every hour, saw her every, you know, there were long periods where I didn't see anybody. Whereas I had two midwives at with me at all times at home. So in a lot of ways, I felt a lot more self. I felt a lot more observed. I felt a lot more, there's a lot more calm. It certainly was in my home birth anyway, because, you know, you're drinking coffee and tea out of your own mugs. You're on your own sofa. There's a lot to be said for familiarity. You know, we're mammals after all. Animals go and kind of take themselves off, don't they? So like a dark, comfortable space. And yeah, we kind of need that sort of nurturing environment to do this. Mm. And hospitals often aren't that. So
especially if you have suffered with weight stigma, you know, as you both mentioned, you know, if every time you're going to the doctor or the hospital, they are bringing up your weight, telling you to lose weight, making assumptions about you, or, you know, just in general, making it about your weight, it becomes a very uncomfortable place to be. And then you're then going to that place to then, for the biggest moment of your life, and something that's already quite stressful. So I'd imagine hospitals and healthcare professionals are not always the people that you, or places you want to be when you're trying to stay very calm, very relaxed, very positive.
And time, you know, if you're told that time and time again that you can't trust your body when it comes to the big moment, like for most folks, of course they're not going to believe that they're going to have a, you know, a safe, completely unremarkable labor, because they've been told time and time again that they can't trust their bodies and something is going to go wrong.
And so you've both turned your experiences into essentially careers or passion projects, you know, whatever you want to call it, both, to be honest, which is so lovely. So Nicola, can you kind of talk around what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis then to support others?
Yeah, so for me, it's around the kind of pre-pregnancy journey. So it's around helping folks access the care that they need in order to get pregnant, whether that is looking at how they can support their bodies kind of through their health goals, but without weight loss and dieting. We look at advocacy, like how they can talk to doctors, how they can access fertility care if that's what they need, what tests and treatments they might need. And, you know, so many people are fobbed off with the just go away and lose weight. It's about really learning those advocacy skills so that we can put our foot down and go, actually, no, I want, you know, evidence-based care. Thank you very much. And also about kind of relearning how to trust your body when you've been told time and time again about, you know, that you can't trust your body, that you're never going to be able to get pregnant, that fat people don't get pregnant. So it's a lot of those kind of factors. But yeah, I support people one to one. I support folks in groups. I try and create a lot of kind of research based resources for people so that they have the knowledge and the resources to then to be able to go and advocate for their own care. Because the biggest thing that stands in the way of fat people getting pregnant is access and choice around their care. It's not that their bodies are fat, it's the fact that they do not get the same type of support and treatment that folks in thinner bodies do.
Nicola, does weight and IVF kind of come up against each other? You know, if you're struggling to get pregnant,
massively,
does it affect you how likely you are to be given IVF?
Yeah, so in the UK, the NHS won't give folks who have a BMI of over 30 access to IVF. And most private clinics have a BMI limit of 40. So if you're beyond 40, you will not get IVF generally in the UK. And a lot of the, so they believe that, you know, the gods that be in the IVF clinics believe that it's more dangerous, that it's not as efficacious. But actually, when you look at the research, more recent research that actually looks at how we can personalized doses for fat bodies, because often fat bodies might need a larger dose of medication, and when you're actually giving people a personalized dose of what they need to support them through IVF, then pregnancy rates are exactly the same, cancellation cycles are exactly the same, like the results are the same. But we just need to do the research on fat people, because historically fat people are excluded from medical research, fat people are excluded from training doctors, from looking at how we support people. So no wonder IVF doesn't, like the initial research showed that it didn't work, because fat people were not included in that research into how it works. So it absolutely can and should be available for all bodies. But unfortunately, it's pretty shocking in the UK right now.
That's really sad. I didn't realise that at all. And like you said, yeah, it just pushes that journey further and further back. What if you have tried to lose weight before and you have not been successful in doing it, you haven't managed to, does that just mean that you can just never have a child? I think that's incredibly
that's
sad.
That's the choice you get, especially for folks who maybe don't have the financial resources to go private or go abroad, for example. Yeah, you either get told you have to lose weight or you don't get to grow your family. And even if you want to explore other options of growing your family, like adoption, that is limited by BMI as well.
Gosh, so many different ways. And then Amber, can you talk us through how you have used your experiences to support other women? I know we've touched on your website, but maybe a little bit more information about that.
Yeah, sure. So I set the website up as a kind of place to put the knowledge that I'd found in terms of kind of research and documents and where to look, because there was no one place that collated that information for people who needed it. So you had to, and especially because obviously we're in the NHS, we're in the UK, we've got a slightly different system to say America or Australia or whatever. So we need stuff that's tailored to what our options may or may not be. So I started setting it up. It's 10 years on now. And yeah, just gradually, I mean, it's a part-time project for me. It's not a career. It's not anything, you know, I try and post something at least once a month. But yeah, if something new comes out, certainly if researchers are looking to do some research and they want to recruit people, or if they want, often now, which is really lovely, I'm getting invited to be involved in PPI, which is patient and public involvement. When people are planning research now, when researchers are planning research, they want to get people that research affects involved in the planning stage, in how things are written. And it's really interesting because I've been on so many conference calls with these researchers, and you know, they're highly intelligent, respected people in their fields. You know, they've got oodles and oodles of knowledge of whatever it is, cardiovascular health or whatever. And then you say something like, so are you going to include people who've got a high BMI and low blood pressure in this study, or is it just going to be people from normal and high blood pressure? And then they just go, oh, do people with high BMI have low blood pressure? Just, it's amazing. Just things, you know, you kind of, we ask questions that people don't think of, because, you know, that's the trouble when you're in a researching box, or you're in your bubble, and you don't push outside of it. You don't necessarily see the questions that need asking. So it's really nice. I'm getting a lot of requests for those kind of things at the moment, either from our group or for me personally. So I'm getting quite a lot of that. Then when we did some research with Wellcome Trust and Parenting Science Gang a few years back, that this post came from, we set up a Facebook group then, and that's kind of been mostly what I've been doing lately. We've got 600 odd members now, and roughly I'd say about one or two posts a day with people kind of asking questions. And you know, quite a lot of the same stuff come up. You know, people say, doctor has recommended this, what is it, what's the evidence for it, should I have it, you know. Or often it's just as simple as, where can I get a decent bra? Because just stuff like that is really important, and it's just not that easy to find a decent supportive bra with no underwires, or a decent supportive bra with like breastfeeding clips, or you're just, so yeah, so there's there. And what's really nice now is it was, you know, it's slow to get going, but now often I'll come to a thread and somebody's posted a question, and multiple people have responded with really lovely, supportive, you know, information-based replies about, you know, what you could do, what I did, what might work, those kind of things. And it's just really lovely to see this group of people supporting each other. So yeah, that's the two things I mainly do: the website, which I try and update when I can, and the Facebook group, which is busy doing its own thing without me half the time, which is wonderful.
That's so great. I think people just need a sense of support from people who are going through a similar experience to them. So I think it's just such a great thing that you're both doing. Do you, to at risk of putting a slightly negative spin on this, do you find that you come up against people who disagree with your messages, or... I'm putting like my Piers Morgan head on, you know, like
I've been interviewed by him, funnily enough.
Haven't you?
No, this is the really, here we go. Here's the nitty gritty. Uh-huh. So I've been interviewed on like Good Morning Britain twice about the Big Bertha site. The first time they set it up like it was going to be, oh, we're going to talk about your site and how you help women. It's going to be lovely. And it wasn't. It was an assassination job. They got a wannabe Katie Hopkins on to kind of talk about how fat people deserve all they're getting and blah, blah, blah. And it turned out she didn't know anything. She was just rent-a-gob they'd put on there. She didn't have any statistics at her fingertips. She didn't know anything she was talking about. So that was my first experience. Second experience was Piers Morgan, and they were like, now you do need to be aware, it's Piers Morgan, he might not be very nice, he might be difficult. And I was like, fully prepared. I'd already had it once by stealth, so I was like, okay, this is going to be this, but 10 times worse. He was lovely to me.
Oh, that's lovely to hear.
I'm traumatized by it.
Everybody's
nice. He complimented my website. He was just, he was a gentleman to me. And I'm just, yes, no, it's not what I expected. But we do get some nonsense. But when you say that, I think I've had, in the 10 years of running the site, I've had one nasty kind of email come through, and we've never had to kick a person off the group.
That's fantastic. Good. Because, you know, I think sometimes you can kind of feel like with social media or the Daily Mail, which I definitely stay away from, you know, you can see people making comments based on very little information, and that must be very hurtful to hear, especially when you do have the facts and the information. So it's amazing to know that you are being left to do your job and to do what you know best.
For me, most people are very friendly as well, but it's definitely my peers that I've had most issues with. So people like fellow coaches, fellow nutritionists who are normally peddling weight loss and dieting that take umbrage to the way that I talk about this work. And yeah, I'm quite active on social media, so I do put myself out there quite a lot, and I do get the occasional trolls, but there's just ways to manage it. You know, like, I don't let people comment. I've definitely got a much thicker skin now in terms of, like, just block and delete is a simple way to get rid of them. I don't need to engage. I don't need to, like, try and prove my points. Like, you know, I'm confident in my work and the research that I do. So, yeah, there are always people that are going to want to, like, you know, throw crap at you, aren't there? But it's just ways to manage it.
I think it is. I think it's important to kind of, you curate your space, and you have the people that you need to support you and support that. And if you found your tribe and you've got those kind of people that you know you can rely on, it's a lot easier to kind of bat that kind of stuff off. When you're just a person on your own who's pregnant and fat and being given all this kind of negative information and seeing it in the press, and I don't know, maybe your mother-in-law saying something, or maybe your dad, or who knows, is saying stuff at you, it's a lot harder. I mean, me and Nicola have had quite a bit of experience of dealing with it for now, and our families are well used to ignoring us, I'm sure. So but it's when those messages come from closer to home as well, I think it's harder for people. And so, yeah, no, I would really say it's really important to get other people on your side, because I didn't know anybody who'd been in the same position as me when I was pregnant. I had nobody to ask and nobody to sort of say, well what's the deal here? It's helpful to have that.
And I mean, at the risk of sounding patronising, you know, Nicola, you were the kind of the person that came to me initially, and quite rightly, you know, we ran a festival, and during it, you said, look, it was for our prenatal fitness page. And you said, you know, really, you should be dealing with more topics that affect, like, women in bigger bodies and you know, other audiences. I completely am on board with that. I think sometimes when it's not your lived experience, you don't even think about it. Is there something that those in, I don't know what we'd even call it, smaller bodies can do to support women in bigger bodies? You know, if we are totally on your side and, you know, we support your message as well. I don't know how to word that question.
So something really simple that folks in thinner bodies can do, like, day to day, is when you go to your GP and they ask you to be weighed, you can say no. And there's only, like, a really small amount of reasons why you might need to be weighed at your GP's office. It could be to do with medication dosing. And there's, you know, for a couple of health conditions, it could be useful. But what that is doing is that it's normalizing not using weight as an indicator of health. And it is so much easier for thinner people to do that than fat people, who it actually then impacts the access to the health that they receive. So it's just a really small thing that folks can do. And you can also amplify, like, fat people's voices on Instagram, social media, Black people, trans people, queer people, like, just, like, you know, using and amplifying their voices and sharing other folks' experiences, disabled folks, neurodivergent folks, because the more we can start to see the world from different people's perspectives, the more it can kind of add richness to our own lives, and also help us to understand where we might be going wrong in supporting people with our own professions and in our own lives. And, you know, I think it just makes us nicer people.
Yeah. I absolutely echo that. And I think, sadly, in a lot of ways, if you're a thin person and you're saying stuff that's kind of what we're advocating, didn't people listen to you more than they listen to me? You know, I mean, I wish that wasn't the case, but you know, I think actually there are some great people on Twitter I follow who are very, very good at navigating that fine line between kind of, you know, yes, telling the story about, you know, this new research that does impact bodies that are bigger, but also kind of going, hang on a second, but that we need to hear. And you know, they're not all fat, the people who do that, but they are people who've got that perspective. And yeah, you don't have to be in a bigger body, you don't have to have that lived experience, you know. And yeah, please just amplify, like Nicola said, that's really cool.
That's really helpful. Thanks, guys. So then to finish, unless we have missed anything, what I was going to do is ask each of you your kind of one top tip or your one piece of advice that you want women in a bigger body out there to hear if they are on the fertility, pregnancy, labour journey. So Nicola, if we start with you.
Yeah. Okay. So if you're in a bigger body right now listening to this, no matter where you are on that journey, I just want you to know that you are absolutely 100% worthy of respectful and appropriate care, no matter where you are. And if you are not getting that, then you are absolutely within your rights to kick up a fuss, seek support from anyone who can help you, and just make sure that you get the care that you need.
That's great. That's so lovely. Thank you, Nicola. Amber, from you?
That's spot on. I would echo that. And I will add to say that anything you are suggested or offered, that is an offer of care. It is for you to choose whether to accept it or not. So if somebody's saying, can you step on the scales? They are offering you the opportunity to weigh yourself. You don't have to do it. If they're suggesting that you have a glucose tolerance test, it is up to you to research it and find out whether you want to accept that offer or not. Everything, unfortunately, tends to be presented as a, you will do this, this is our procedure. It doesn't have to be. Okay, you can make your own pathway. It does involve kicking up a fuss quite often, and it's not always popular, but you can manage your care, you can manage your thing. There's an acronym called BRAIN, which helps you kind of, I won't go through it, but it helps you kind of evaluate all the different parts of a decision and whether you should or shouldn't do it, what information you need. So that could be really helpful.
That's great. Thank you so much, guys. It's been so interesting, and I hope that it's opened up lots of our listeners' eyes to the experiences of other people. And I really hope that it goes on to help lots of other women. So thank you so, so much to both of you. And I hope that everyone's enjoyed listening. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Firstly, I want to say a huge thank you to my guests today for being so open and honest about personal topics on such a public platform. That takes real bravery and will help so many others. I genuinely believe that one person's honesty can help free many. If you found today's episode helpful, please do head to the show notes to find links and support our guests feel may be useful. Secondly, this podcast can only help those who know about it. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would mean so much to me if you could rate us with a 5-star rating and leave us a review, or hit follow to be the first to hear when our next episode lands. While podcasts are easy to listen to, they take a lot of effort to create, and your support in sharing Bun in the Oven will help me encourage more guests to join me for future episodes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and enjoy the rest of your day.